If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. We are thrilled to be here with you today. We have a great show for you today. We have two amazing guests. One of them is making his Katie Halper Show debut. So huge things are going to be happening for this guest professionally. You're not going to believe it. He's not going to believe it. Before we start, though, please do, of course, like the stream. That's a free way to support the show. It's not just about ego and validation, but also it's a great way to push back on the algorithmic suppression that happens on shows like these. And we want to make sure that people hear the very important voices that we are bringing on both tonight, but more generally speaking. So just give it a thumbs up, give it a like. Also subscribe, and that way you won't miss any extra streams that we do. We always stream Tuesdays at 7 p.m., but we also do these extra streams often. So this week, we're actually going to be interviewing Omar Suleiman, who is a brilliant Palestinian-American imam who is also, according to Israel, one of the top 10 biggest anti-Semites, which is hilarious because he and Greta Thunberg are both on that list and they are both above the great Nick Fuentes. So I guess you have to anti-Semite harder, Nick Fuentes, so you can get up higher on that list. That will be Thursday at 12 p.m. EST. So make sure you tune in for that. And again, to subscribe, you just hit subscribe and then you press the bell. Also, please do become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. That gives you access to great extra shows, extra interviews, early release. Also, if you can do it at the $5 a month level, that's what gives you the extra access. If you can't swing that, you can still make this show happen by becoming a supporter at the $1 a month level. And in fact, between the first two guests, I will be reading out the names of all of our recent Patreon supporters, and let's see if we can get any patrons during this show so that I can read your names, because I know that's a very exciting thing for people. Okay, so I think that's all of the announcements, and now we're just going to get into the great show that we have for you tonight. So we are really excited to be bringing on, for the first time ever, Sharif Abdul-Qaddous, who is a journalist and editor at Dropsite News and a producer of the Palestine Festival of Literature, and someone who used to be for many, many years at Democracy Now!, and he does great work. Welcome to the show, Sharif.
It's good to be here.
Of course. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to ask you to start off, what do you think the most important stories are right now that people need to be focusing on coming out of West Asia, coming out of the Middle East? What do you think either is most important or most misrepresented and that needs to be unpacked?
I mean, that's a difficult question because there's so much happening at the moment in Iran, in Palestine, in Lebanon, and beyond. But I think right now, as we're speaking, Iran is probably most in the spotlight because we were just hours away from the ceasefire, which has been in place for about 2 weeks, exactly 2 weeks, was about to expire. And the second round of talks in Islamabad was not about to happen. And just a couple of hours ago, before this broadcast, the ceasefire has been extended. And I think we have to take stock of where we are at the moment. So, you know, this war was launched by the United States and Israel on February 28th. And it was announced by President Trump as a regime change war. You know, he said that the people will rise up and topple this government and that it would be a quick war, basically. And what we saw was that it developed into a war of attrition in which Iran stunned the U.S. and Israel and international observers. Basically, you know, Iran cannot match the United States and Israel with its military power. Iran's military budget is about 1% of the U.S. military budget, which is by far the largest in the world. But what it did engage in was very effective asymmetric warfare, where it targeted it shouldn't be a surprise what Iran's response was. They said that they were going to do this. They said multiple times that we're not going to, as in previous times we were attacked, we're not going to give a measured response. We're not going to telegraph our attacks. This time, we are going to attack U.S. Bases, U.S. military assets in the region. We're going to attack Israel, and we're not going to hold back. And that's exactly what they did. You know, despite its leadership and much of its leadership being assassinated in the opening days of the war, it managed to withstand that and then retaliate with massive airstrikes, drone strikes, and really inflicted unprecedented damage on U.S. military infrastructure across the Persian Gulf. It forced the evacuation of more than a dozen military bases. You know, only U.S. Service members related to the Air Force are operating on those bases. Everyone else was evacuated because of the scale of the attack. And of course, we saw them consolidate control over one of the world's most strategically vital waterways, Strait of Hormuz. You know, and this, as they've come out of this, in a very, very strong position. And we have to remember that Iran was attacked twice in the middle of negotiations with the United States. And so this time, they were not going to stop the war until they had some kind of guarantee that this would not happen again. Now, it's almost impossible to get a guarantee from the United States, especially from President Trump, who's incredibly erratic, and there's no trust. Of course, there's no trust anymore after you're attacked twice while you're negotiating. But what they did manage to do was to make the United States and Israel think twice again before attacking Iran, because they exacted a very heavy cost. Israel's interceptors and missile defense are running out. The U.S. missile interceptors and missile defense is running out, and in Gulf states as well. And of course, it's affected the global economy. Gas prices, the price of oil, other downstream products like fertilizer affecting the price of food. And so this is not something that they can withstand. And so what we've seen basically is that Iran has emerged in a position where the U.S. was actually trying to find an exit ramp for this war. We know that they were contacting U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff maybe a week into the war, 10 days, and Iran did not answer those calls, did not take up negotiations. They continued for about 40 days until we have this current ceasefire. And now we're in this very precarious position where I don't think Iran will fire first. But the ceasefire is being extended, but they have refused to go to Islamabad because the United States has imposed a naval blockade. They insist that must be lifted before any talks resume. So we're in this situation now where, it's a very precarious situation. The war could start up at any moment. The U.S. and Israel are presumably rearming, but so is Iran. But it's been put in probably the strongest position it's been in 10 years.
Right. So do you think that it was surprising to you as a journalist who's covered this area? Were you less surprised by Iran's response than, let's say, the U.S. government or Donald Trump and his administration?
I mean, if any analyst was in the government was actually listening to what Iran was saying, they shouldn't have been surprised. I think we're all surprised by, that this war happened. You know, they've been neoconservatives and others in the U.S. administration have been talking about war with Iran for so long. But this is a very large country, a very powerful country. And, the scale of it, we never thought it would actually happen. But then it was launched on February 28th. And so, I mean, it was surprising. You're seeing people talked about it as World War III. There's 10 countries involved. Missiles and bombs are raining down all over the region. So it was quite frightening, to be honest. But surprised with Iran's response? No, because this is what they said they were going to do.
Yeah, I think that there's a major underestimating that we've seen. That I guess isn't surprising in itself. Like we should have expected, or just as it's reasonable to expect Iran to have done what it's done, I think it's also reasonable to expect Trump and his administration to not have taken that seriously.
Well, and look, they're in a position now where they're, Trump keeps saying how they've totally decimated Iran's missile capability. That's obviously not the case. They have continued to fire up until the ceasefire. They haven't achieved one single objective of the war, and now it seems they're desperate for an off-ramp. But Iran is in a position where it has to force the U.S., force Israel, force world powers to not consider another strike. And the only way it does that is it has control over the Strait of Hormuz. This is, I think, also a paradigm change in the way the global economy is going to work going forward. And I think they have exacted that cost, but we'll have to see what happens in these coming days with these talks.
Now, how does this relate to what Israel is doing in Lebanon, in Gaza? As you've pointed out, what's happening in Gaza is getting overshadowed by what's happening in Iran, and what's happening in the West Bank, obviously, is getting overshadowed by Gaza. So how do you deal with knowing what to cover, especially given that so many things are so urgent?
I mean, we try and cover as much as possible. We don't do something groundbreaking at Dropsite. We do basic journalism, and we are just covering a major gap in this country and in much of Western Europe when it comes to coverage of this region, of the Arab world and Iran, because we're doing basic, coverage of what's happening in Gaza. What's happening in Gaza is a continuation of the genocide. These are not my assessments. It's the assessment of places like Amnesty International, of Human Rights Watch. They're continuing. They've violated the ceasefire every single day since it was signed on October 10th. But much of the attention of the world has shifted away because there's wars in Lebanon, there's wars in Iran that are happening. We can talk about what the status quo is right now in Gaza, which is that Israeli troops withdrew to what's called the Yellow Line, which is basically a line that runs roughly parallel to the coast line. And, on Israeli maps, it's supposed to take up 53% of Gaza. Since then, they have moved in, and it's closer to 60%. So they have basically taken half of Gaza. They have, in the area that it controls, been building military bases, outposts, roads that are connected to settlements and bases outside of Gaza in Israel. And so they're consolidating control. This is supposed to be a phased ceasefire with a phased withdrawal all the way back to what's called a buffer zone. But what's happening on the ground is it seems to be permanent occupation and permanent settlement of this part of Gaza. At the same time, they are continuing to kill and attack Palestinians almost every single day in Gaza. They killed 9 over the past 24 hours. People don't hear about that. They have not allowed in life essentials into Gaza as agreed upon, to the level that it was agreed upon in the ceasefire. I don't say aid because this is stuff like food, medicine, shelter materials. These are life essentials. And they're also beginning to construct these Orwellian housing, what they call alternative safe communities, that are essentially a new variation on a refugee camp for a new generation of dispossessed Palestinians that will be controlled by biometrics for Palestinians to get in and out, that will have a kind of re-education programs in the school curriculum. And this is all laid out in documents that we published at DropSite. A military school curriculum that's based on what they called a culture of peace. This is a reference to the Abraham Accords that were signed by the United Arab Emirates. And it's basically promoting normalization with Israel. So essentially teaching Palestinian children to accept subjugation, essentially. And this is the nightmare that they hope to build in Gaza. At the same time, we've seen Palestinians incredibly steadfast in staying on their land. You know, every time that there was a ceasefire, however brief and however fragile and violated by Israel, we saw tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians moving back to the north, moving back to their land. Even though their homes were completely destroyed, they were determined to go back and set up tents on the rubble of their homes. And it's this kind of return, I think, that it means that Palestinian resistance still exists, essentially. You know, the UN and the World Bank recently put out a report that said that human development in Gaza has been set back 77 years, that the reconstruction over the next 10 years would require at least over $70 billion. And, you know, this is the genocide needs to end first for all of this to begin. And what we're seeing in Lebanon is Gaza-style tactics. This has been said by the Israeli defense minister, Israel Katz. He said that we are going to, especially in southern Lebanon and close to the border, the villages and towns there, we're going to make them look like Rafah and Beit Hanun, two places in Gaza that have been completely leveled and razed to the ground. So, we're working on a story now where, I mean, let's remember, there's a fifth of the Lebanese population has been displaced in this last phase of the war. I won't say that the war started on March 2nd. This was just the latest phase of the war. The war really started in October 2023. And you could argue that it really started in 1978 when Israel first invaded Lebanon. But a fifth of the population has been displaced. And many of the people from these border towns are now scrambling to get, sometimes they pool their money and get satellite images of their town to try and look and see if their home has been destroyed or not. And now Israel wants to create, they published a map with their area of control, or what they want their area of control to be, which is several kilometers running along the border on the south and southeast of Lebanon. And this that they want to create permanent occupation in. They all the way up to the Litani River, they admitted that they can't occupy that the way they did in 1982 to 2000 after Hezbollah forced them out. But that this zone will be subject to kind of constant bombardment and surveillance and Israeli control from without. And finally, they said that north of the Litani River, that they want the Lebanese government and the Lebanese army to disarm Hezbollah, which, of course, they cannot do. Hezbollah is much, much stronger. And Hezbollah's argument, and rightly so, is that the army cannot defend against Israel. And this is a key thing. People have to understand that the Lebanese army is armed and funded by the United States, mostly. And by design, the United States will not build up the Lebanese army to a capacity where it can defend itself against Israel. The special envoy, Tom Barrack, last year admitted to this offhandedly. He said, we're not arming the Lebanese army to defend against Israel. We're arming it to take on Hezbollah. This reverberated across Lebanon, by the way. It was said offhanded by him and didn't get much coverage here. But this is the point. So Hezbollah has an argument that is correct. I mean, who else has the power to fight Israel? At the end of the day, I mean, they have suffered tremendously. They've lost their longtime leaders, Hassan Nasrallah. They've lost a lot of commanders and many of their rank and file. They took a very big hit. But they have still continuing in very fierce resistance. And if you look at actually Israel's ground operations, they are a very meager fighting force on the ground, actually. They have tremendous air power because of the United States, giving it the most up-to-date weapons and an unlimited supply of bombs. But when they actually proceed on the ground, we saw it in Gaza, and we see it in Lebanon, these resistance fighters who have really, you know, not much in terms of weapons, are able to inflict casualties, are able to hold them off. And they were able to exact a price. And so that's why Israel is determined to try and destroy Hezbollah, destroy Lebanese resistance, to destroy Hamas, destroy Palestinian resistance. But it has been unable to so far.
Yeah. A lot of Americans, I think, don't understand. They kind of flatten all countries into one monolith. They don't understand, even though it's obvious to anyone who's looking at it, that Hezbollah and the Lebanese government are not the same thing. I mean, people are getting that more and more, but I honestly think that some people, that they think that either Hezbollah is just a terrorist organization, or they think it's just part of the government, and they think that the rest of the Lebanese government is, you know, they're all Lebanese. Like, there's a kind of racist misunderstanding, I think, of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also a great misunderstanding of why Hezbollah is allowed to keep its weapons. I mean, so you have to go back. Hezbollah was founded as a resistance movement to Israel after Israel invaded Lebanon again in 1982, a much larger invasion, and invaded Beirut. Hezbollah, a few years later, was formed as a resistance movement to Israel. Now, in 1990, at the end of the Lebanese Civil War, something called the Taif Agreement that was brokered by Saudi Arabia and Syria and also had U.S. input, it called on all of Lebanon's militias, and there was a constellation of militias fighting in the Civil War for 15 years. So all of them disarmed, but Hezbollah got an exception because Hezbollah was recognized as the national resistance to Israeli occupation in the south, which was ongoing. Israel occupied from 1982 to 2000 all of the land of Lebanon up to the Litani River. Okay, so, and then Hezbollah in 2000 forced Israel to withdraw from southern Lebanon. And they achieved something that really no Arab military army had been able to do in all the wars with Israel, was to force Israel to relinquish Arab land without a peace agreement. And that really bolstered the standing of Hezbollah in the Arab world. In 2006, in yet another war with Israel, Hezbollah basically fought Israel to a standstill, which was seen as a major victory. And it was a major victory. They were, you know, against, you know, they're completely outgunned and outmanned, but they fought them to a standstill. And so, you know, this is where we're at. But there is, you know, Lebanese society is fractured, and there are significant portions of the political political landscape of Lebanon that do want to disarm Hezbollah, and we're seeing now that the Lebanese government is engaging again this week on Thursday in DC with a second round of talks directly with Israel, and we haven't seen that since 1993. So this is, trying to foment more kind of divisions in Lebanese political society. But we'll have to see where that goes also.
Right. Well, you mentioned Tom Barrack, the special U.S. special envoy, and what he said that was offhand and that wasn't really picked up in the United States, but was in Lebanon. Here's a clip of him from this summer, August of 2025, during a press briefing, and he had some interesting things to say to an audience that was basically Lebanese journalists.
Wait. Let's have one rule. Let's have one rule, okay? You just had three of the most... Okay, wait. This we're going to have a different set of rules, right? You want... Please be quiet for a moment. And I want to tell you something. The moment that this starts becoming chaotic, like animalistic, we're gone. So you want to know what's happening? Act civilized, act kind, act tolerant, because this is the problem with what's happening in the region.
I mean, spoken like a true colonial imperialist, right? You know, you're acting like you're uncivilized, coming from a government and a power that has backed some of the most barbaric, military campaign we've seen in generations. What's happening with the genocide in Gaza, what's happening in Lebanon. And when I talk about that they're using Gaza-style tactics in Lebanon, it's not just that they're completely demolishing and razing the land and history and Lebanese society and villages that have stood for so long. They are assassinating journalists and openly bragging about it, that Israel has done that. They assassinated Ali Shoaib, who was a veteran Lebanese journalist. They bragged about it the next day. Also, they killed alongside him another journalist, Fatma Ftouni, and her brother, Mohammed Ftouni, who's a cameraman as well. They have targeted openly and admitted to it medical workers. Over 90 medical workers have been killed in the past 6 weeks alone in Lebanon, with the Israeli military spokesperson saying, we're going to target ambulances because they're supposedly being used by Hezbollah with absolutely no evidence. And even if they were, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to bomb a hospital. You're not allowed to bomb an ambulance. You're not allowed in double tap strikes, triple tap strikes. And for someone like the U.S. envoy, Tom Barrack, to say you act civilized, I mean, it's laughable if it wasn't so serious.
Right. And he, of course, ironically, or maybe not ironically, given how colonialism works, but he himself is of Lebanese background.
Yeah. I mean,
that's how you get a job like that, right? By being willing to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
But also, again, it's not a monolith, right? Like, being Lebanese doesn't align you.
No, you know, Lebanon has, there's a right-wing Christian forces, the Lebanese forces there. They were involved in the massacre in Sabra Shatila, engaged in it in collusion with Israel. You know, there's a large Sunni population. I mean, Lebanon was set up as a sectarian society where you have different sects that occupy different positions, the prime minister, the speaker, the president, all of these are assigned to different sects. And actually growing up in Lebanon, you're very much dependent because the state is very weak and you're very much dependent on kind of like your sect and political faction to provide services, school and healthcare and these sorts of things. Not to say that society is like fractured. I mean, people obviously... they're together in many ways, but on a political level, it's very, very divided.
I want to ask you about your personal journey as a journalist. How did you start this work? You've covered so many areas. Obviously, you're fluent in Arabic. You are from Egypt. Tell us about your being a journalist today, especially someone who covers what you cover and is from where you are from.
I mean, I started as a journalist in 2003 at Democracy Now!, right around the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. I was very lucky to get a job there, and I'm very fortunate and honored to call Amy Goodman my mentor. And Jeremy Scahill, a good friend of mine and my colleague at Dropside News, always said that journalism is not a profession, it's a trade. And you need to apprentice and you need a mentor and you need to just learn by doing it. And so I learned it at Democracy Now! And yes, I grew up in Egypt. I'm fluent in Arabic. And I moved back to Egypt in 2011, once the Egyptian revolution began, to cover it and to take part in it. And I stayed there for another 11 years, covering the region. And actually the place that I covered the most and traveled to the most, other than Egypt, was Palestine, was Gaza, actually. Egypt shares a border with Gaza, the only border that's not controlled by Israel or wasn't before the genocide, and now is again. And that was a place that I covered. And actually, like many people of my generation in the region, I was politicized by Palestine. It was the second Palestinian Intifada that in 2000 that politicized me. And it's a very foundational thing. It was actually one of the first major protests, and protesters in Cairo took over Tahrir Square was in solidarity with Palestinians during the Second Intifada. So this is kind of a foundational thing. But I also, over those years, traveled to Syria, to Yemen, to Libya, to Bahrain, to Algeria, and covered different struggles there. And honestly, it's been very difficult once the genocide began in Gaza to watch it from afar. International journalists have been barred by Israel as well as Egypt of going in. This is not to say that Palestinian journalists, who are the best journalists covering Gaza and have, I think, performed one of the most heroic acts in history in covering this genocide and have been targeted and slaughtered and assassinated and hunted in an unprecedented way. But international journalists should be allowed in order to share in their labor of covering this war and also to act as a shield. But covering it from afar has been horrifying. I think all of us have been changed by this. There have been genocides before in the past, but never live streamed on our phones, watching it unfold as it's happening, watching it unfold while it's being enabled, backed, and applauded by the most powerful countries in the world. And, I feel honored that I have been able to work with Palestinian journalists in Gaza, both doing documentaries on fault lines, but also, on an almost daily basis for Dropsite. One of the best journalists in northern Gaza and in Gaza in general was Hossam Shabet, and he was writing for Dropsite, and he was assassinated in March of last year. I was speaking to him literally hours before he was killed, and we published his last article. He filed his last article really just hours before. And there's something very difficult to contend with in that I don't know how I could have protected him. He knew he was being hunted. He was being openly called by Israeli military officials, telling him to leave the north, to stop reporting. They would send him his pin location on WhatsApp to show that they knew where he was. And he was determined to continue his coverage every day of the genocide of his people. And he was hungry. He was displaced over 20 times. And yet he continued this work. This is what's very distressing, is that I feel like I failed him, like we all failed him, actually. And that now, it's now spreading. They're now assassinating journalists in Lebanon. And who knows how this is going to affect the world. And there's been a massive, massive betrayal by U.S. media institutions around the killing of their colleagues. These are their colleagues. These are journalists in another country. And they have been openly targeted and killed in this way. And the coverage of their killings has enabled Israel to continue doing this.
Yes. Can you elaborate on that? That's a point that you've made very passionately and convincingly, because it's undeniable, as has your colleague, Leila Al-Aryan. So I also want to acknowledge her. And you, of course, have worked on projects together. But yeah, can you elaborate on that?
Yes, Leila is a fantastic journalist, and I worked with her and Kavitha Shakuru on a documentary called The Night Will End about Gaza, about the genocide. But if you look at the coverage, you can just compare the coverage of how they cover, for example, crackdowns on journalists in other countries compared to the unprecedented killing of journalists in Palestine. So, for example, when the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was wrongfully imprisoned by Russia and held in Moscow on fabricated charges, the headline of the New York Times, if you look at it once he's convicted, said, Evan Gershkovich convicted on fabricated charges. That's the language they use. There's no equivocation. And that's good journalism, actually, because those are fabricated charges. This is a journalist. When it comes to Palestinian journalists, who are openly assassinated, and the Israeli military is bragging about it and saying things like, don't let the press vest fool you, and saying without any evidence whatsoever that these journalists are militants, then you'll see the lead, the headline, say, Israel kills journalist it says was Hamas militant. in the copy, they'll say, and in the lead, they will front load Israel's claims. Then they'll say, you know, for example, with Anas Sharif, who became the most prominent journalist in Gaza after Waled Dahdour, who was forced to leave after nearly his entire family was killed and he was severely injured. Anas Sharif was saying, they're going to kill me because the Israeli military kept threatening him openly and so forth. They killed him. They assassinated him on August 10th and killed five other journalists alongside him in a media tent outside a hospital in an airstrike, bragged about it. The coverage, and Anas Sharif was part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning team at Reuters for photography. They won the Pulitzer Prize for photography. One of the submissions was a photograph by Anas Sharif of the massive bombing of Jabalia refugee camp where he's from, with a 2,000-pound bomb. And you can see the crater. The way Reuters covered his assassination was to say Israel kills journalists, they say, is Hamas leader, then to put the claim in the lead, and then to say his employer, Al Jazeera, which is funded by the Qatari government, denies it. I mean, this is beyond the pale. Not that the claims by Israel have been found to be unsubstantiated by the Committee to Protect Journalists, by the United Nations. No, just that his employer, and, you know, in a parenthesis, funded by the Qatari government, denies it. And so this kind of coverage enables Israel to continue, it tampers the outrage around the world, because most people, this is what they're going to read. Reuters is a massive news agency. And there's been a serious abrogation, and I would argue complicity in these continued killings. And, you know, and sometimes it goes to actual incitement. The New Yorker, a few weeks into the genocide in October, at the end of October, published this horrendous piece about how journalists like Waled Dahdour, the Gaza bureau chief for Al Jazeera, is basically promoting Hamas propaganda. And in that way, just saying that he's not really a journalist and allowing for him to be targeted. And this is a man who lost his wife, his child, his grandchild, his son. So, it's been, you know, there should be black banners across every newspaper in the United States every day. There have been over 260 journalists killed. In the first 10 weeks of the war, of the genocide, more journalists have been killed in Gaza than CPJ had recorded over any year in history. So we're talking about something that is changing. This is, and what shocks me even more is, okay, even forget what you think about imperialism or colonialism or genocide, even for your own interest as a journalist. This is not a danger to journalists just in Palestine or to journalists in the Arab world. This is a danger to journalists everywhere. Now, anytime, anywhere, in any conflict, the US can't say anything if a government wants to target and kill a journalist. But can you imagine if they were Russia or, you know, an enemy of the United States was assassinating U.S. journalists in this way, the outrage of the papers. It's just crazy. The New York Times, after the killing of Anas Sharif, did this horrendous piece about, you know, what is Al Jazeera, you know, the broadcaster that angers governments around the world. And then it was kind of like this hit piece in Al Jazeera. Can you imagine if five New York Times journalists were assassinated by a military and Al Jazeera then said, you know, the New York Times, the paper that angers, you know, governments around the world and kind of justifying it. It's really shameful.
Yeah, it's really obscene. And then you have Israel, literally the other day, they admitted that someone who they accused of being, I can't even remember, was it that someone they accused of being Hamas, they had a photo of him. And when Trey Yinks from Fox News asked them where it came from, they were like, oh, unfortunately, we don't have it because it was photoshopped.
That's Ali Shoaib. That's a Lebanese guy. That was a Lebanese journalist who was a, you know, a veteran, very well known. And basically, I think the day after he was assassinated, they put up a photo which kind of had like a line through it, with one side of his normal clothes and then the other half him dressed in military fatigues. And the Israeli military had to admit that they photoshopped it.
Yeah. I don't even know if they knew that they were admitting something. You know, like, they're so entitled and coddled that I think, honestly, when they said, oh, unfortunately, it's photoshopped, They weren't even saying it's unfortunate that like we photoshopped it. It's just like, oh, unfortunately, it's a photoshopped photo of something that is real.
Well, they're entitled and coddled because they've been allowed to do this with zero accountability, with full impunity. They didn't used to do this at the beginning of the genocide. They used to say it's collateral damage. Exactly, we didn't mean it when they killed a journalist. Then we started to see just a few months in after they killed the journalist, they would say this wasn't a journalist, it was a militant. Then they started to make hit lists. We're going to kill these journalists. And like they did with Hossam Shabet and Anas Sharif, they're basically saying we're going to kill them, and then they kill them. And they even did it to one journalist, Hassan Aslayah. Most people don't know him, but he's very big in Gaza. They bombed him in outside Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunus, killed two other journalists. I don't know if you remember, there was a haunting image of one of the journalists sitting in a tent on fire. He burnt to death. Hassan was very badly burned. He lost two of his fingers. He had a concussion. He's recovering in hospital. And the Israeli military at the time said, we tried to kill him, but, you know, we didn't. He's recovering in hospital. 3 weeks later, they bomb the hospital and kill him. They bomb a hospital, which already is beyond
what war crime.
And then they to assassinate a wounded journalist that they tried to kill before, and zero consequences. So, of course, they're going to keep pushing the line further and further because they pay no price. There's no consequence.
Also, at the same time as that, you have Israel defenders up in arms about an actual photograph. And Brad, you can probably find this. This is the famous, it was an Italian newspaper. And they had a photo of a guy who was very ugly.
Oh, the settler soldier, yes.
Yeah, the settler soldier, right? Who happened to be very ugly. And then they said it was anti-Semitic. And literally, like, first of all, not to pull the as a Jew thing, but that's not helpful. Like, don't show someone ugly and say it's anti-Semitic. Because what are you saying? First of all, you're literally just saying, oh, he's ugly, so he looks like a Jew. I mean, these people are, but whatever. That's the least of it. It's just ironic because, as we all know, Israel and Israel defenders are actually happy to create anti-Semitism, and they want to create it.
I mean, Zionists ally with open anti-Semites, and in many ways, Zionism is an anti-Semitic ideology.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like Herzl said, anti-Semites will be our greatest friends, anti-Semitic nations, our greatest allies.
Yeah.
But yeah, they accused people of creating this, that it wasn't really him. And then, of course, they have footage of it. And then they move to, oh, you think this is abusive? Look, it's actually the woman who's abusing him.
Yeah. And there's actually, you know, then the video was released showing what the context of this and, you know, them coming to harass a group of Palestinians, and she's kind of being quite brave and like shooing him away.
Maybe that's abusive, according to these people, who literally, first they say it's not true. Then the video comes up. They're like, well, actually, who's the real abuser? I mean, you can't make it up. Well, Sharif, thank you so much. I could keep talking to you for hours, but I know you have so much important work to do. And so we really thank you for your generous time. And we hope you come back and keep up your amazing work. Oh, really quickly, I have to ask you about this because you wrote an article talking about brave journalists. You wrote an article about Ahmed, who is right now, he's been detained for 7 weeks?
Yes, Ahmed Shahabuddin is an American-born Kuwaiti citizen. It's also, you know, Palestinian roots. He's an award-winning journalist. He has, you know, more than 2 million followers on social media across platforms. He worked with PBS Frontline, with Al Jazeera English, with Vice on HBO, Huffington Post. Really kind of a well-known journalist in the region and an outspoken voice. And he was visiting family in Kuwait when the war in Iran broke out, and he was arrested in Kuwait on March 3rd. And from what we understand, there hasn't been a lot of transparency around the case, but he was arrested for social media posts, and he posted a photo or reposted, actually, a video showing a U.S. fighter jet crashing near a U.S. base in Kuwait. You know, this was like a friendly fire incident. And this was, you know, shared by CNN and many other people. And he reposted it. But he's been imprisoned over this. He's been held in, you know, conditions in, we don't know the conditions exactly, but the conditions in Kuwaiti prisons are, you know, overcrowding and bad sanitation and all of this. But he basically is facing charges, from what we understand, that may include these kind of catch-all allegations of false information, misuse of a mobile phone. And we've seen these kinds of, are harming national security, these kinds of charges used by governments in Kuwait, in Egypt, and across the region to crack down on online speech, essentially. And Kuwait has engaged in a very, very fierce crackdown, as have many countries, U.S. allies in the Gulf, arresting people for online posts, deporting journalists. And, you know, Ahmed has basically been in prison for the past 50 days with limited access to his lawyer. And from what we understand, he may also be facing prosecution in a special tribunal that was set up just last month by the Kuwaiti government to prosecute terrorism and state security cases, which is really very troubling. But he's just one of hundreds that have been thrown behind bars. The United Arab Emirates has arrested over 400 people in Abu Dhabi alone for online posts. Saudi Arabia has arrested people. Bahrain tortured someone to death. You know, the U.S. government should be pressing for his release because he is a U.S. citizen. But there are hundreds like him who need to be free as well.
Yes. Well, thank you for covering that. And we will link to that article. You have a lot of fans in the chats and asking where your channel was. And I said at DropSite, obviously, that's where your work can be found. And please do come back on the show because this has been amazing.
Thank you, Katie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. All right. That was obviously a joke when I said at the beginning, like, oh, big things are going to happen for this guy because he's a very established, prolific, amazing journalist. But that's a joke I like to make all the time.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
I absolutely love that first firing up of the grill on a warm summer evening. Do you or someone else in your home take grilling as seriously as I do? The Burger Perfection Pack is an incredible deal for just $99.99. This exclusive package includes 20 of Omaha Steaks' mouth-watering steak burgers. That's four of each of their finest burgers. Pure ground filet mignon, New York strip, ribeye, brisket, and sirloin. Only available at omahasteaks.com. Impress your next dinner party or family cookout with exclusive products not available at grocery stores. All backed by Omaha Steaks' 100% money-back guarantee. Get ready for grilling season with the mouth-watering Omaha Steaks Burger Perfection Pack. Plus 8 free Wagyu Smash Burgers for just $99.99. Go to omahasteaks.com and as a bonus, use promo code YUM to get $35 off your order. That's $35 off with promo code YUM. Terms apply. See site for details.
One of the Patreon things that you're going to be getting, probably not this week, but probably next week, because there's there are a lot of challenges with it because of the way it was filmed. You'll get a sense of why, is an interview that I did with Jeremy Corbyn in Cuba. So it's pretty great. Actually, we have two things to show you. One is Brad is going to show you the Trey Yingst video. But first, you can play the teaser of me and Corbyn in Cuba. And then I will bring on our next guest, Yasha Levine, who I'm so excited to bring on. Join the Patreon so that you can see the rest of this interview with Jeremy Corbyn, which we won't have for you this week, but sometime after this week. Okay.
We want Cuba to survive, but we're here also to get urgent aid coming in. Can't we say to the audience in the USA, do everything you can, everything, to force the Trump administration to lift the blockade and allow the oil to come into Cuba so that Cuba can at least keep the lights on. As you've observed, there's no lights around here.
Right.
Those lights are battery lights from our phones, and I don't know how long they're going to last.
Yeah, well,
but you see, we're...
Yeah.
It's beautiful, this darkness, but...
Yeah.
And we're enjoying it, but just imagine, you'd come home from work, you get home, like 6, and then by 7 o'clock it's dark, and there's a power cut.
Right.
And that's it.
And not to mention how it's a death sentence for some people.
There's no cooking, there's no television, there's nothing.
But also no dialysis, right?
Dialysis can't happen, anything else. All the stuff that we absolutely take for granted because we've got electricity is not available to ordinary, decent people in Cuba. Come on, it's just plain wrong, isn't it?
Yes, it's sadistic.
It's very demonstrative of the reality when you're in a country that is being starved of medicine and energy and power. There's not a lot of lights.
...were killed, including Ali Shuaib, who worked for the Hezbollah-affiliated Al-Manor television network. The IDF accused Shuaib of operating as a member of Hezbollah's Radwan forces and included a photo of him wearing a military uniform. When asked by Fox News about the source of the photo, the IDF responded, quote, "Unfortunately, there isn't really a picture of it. It was photoshopped." The IDF announced they have conducted new raids into southern Lebanon over the weekend, taking troops from southern Syria into southern Lebanon. Guys?
Thank you, Trey. Trey Yingst, who's at Fox, has been more outspoken than any other mainstream journalist on Israel's crimes, including their war on journalists. So what does it say about liberal media or non-Fox media when you have to go to Fox News to hear that?
Well, and I think I could be wrong, but the impression that I get is, and I can understand, rightly so, you would think this based on how much the U.S. mainstream media, and let alone Fox News in the USA, has been full-throatedly promoting any and all lines of BS from Israel in the last few years. Why wouldn't they think? They're talking to friends. So, when they're asked about that, they're like, yeah, that was Photoshopped. I don't think that they understood. Right. I think they were so used to it. And they're like, yeah, it's just some friends talking to us.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, my point stands that Trey Yingst is actually pathetically one of the only people who have spoken out against or even just covered Israel's journals, journalist side. Anyway, well, thanks for playing those things. And isn't that cool? That thing with Corbyn, it's really cute because also we have some cute little kids talking to us.
Well, and I was saying to the audience too, the video quality leaves something to be desired, but in a certain way, I actually think that it speaks to the condition in the country. That's the reality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's see, where are we on likes? Because we're going to bring on Yasha, and this man deserves to be liked. Let us bring on to the show, back onto the show, Yasha Levine, journalist, filmmaker of Pistachio Wars and several other films. And we're just going to bring him onto the show because he requires no introduction.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, you?
Not bad. I hope it's allowed to enjoy a beer while being on the stream.
Of course, yeah. We should have gotten the sponsorship, though, from them.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I'll hide the corporate label.
And then once they pay me money, then I'll...
Exactly. Then we can release it. Exactly. We can do an AI filter on it.
Actually, Brad could do that and would spend about 17,000 hours doing it. Well, welcome back to the show. There's a lot to talk about with you. We'll save the Palantir question I have for you to the end or to later on because It's pretty interesting because you accuse Palantir of trolling everyone with their manifesto.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna maybe try to get you to troll Palantir about trolling us, meta trolling.
Well, let's see. Yeah.
Tell us about the relationship between pistachios and Iran.
Well, it's a pretty significant relationship. You know, Iran has for time immemorial has been sort of the leading producer of pistachios in the region, and you know, when global trade got off the ground to the world, so Iran is synonymous with it's like very much part of the Iranian and Persian culture, and it's just a producer of pistachios. You know, that's just, I mean, other countries produce pistachios too in the region, like Turkey and things like that, but it's like Iran is like it's synonymous with the country and with the culture, and pistachios are an important export also for the country, you know, bringing in, you know, foreign currencies and things like that, especially, you know, in difficult times of sanctions. So, of course, you know, pistachios now are, California actually is now the leading exporter of pistachios to the world. It recently overtook Iran as, and basically stole its market share. And so, no longer are pistachios synonymous with Iran. Now, pistachios, it seems like, are synonymous with California and with a certain oligarch Zionist family that really controls the industry and has a monopoly on the industry in California, and they live in Beverly Hills and all this stuff. So, yeah, it's there's a lot to talk about, I guess.
The beautiful Resnicks. We can I'll get a photo of them so people can see what they look like.
Yes. Linda and Stuart Resnick. And their company, of course, is called Wonderful.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And we can get into, I mean, they literally have, you know, they own the brand Wonderful.
Right.
You know? So you know that they're pretty evil when someone really has to name their company Wonderful. And they're sort of bad in all sorts of ways, but we can get into some of them.
And we actually have a trailer, I believe.
Oh, yeah, that'll help me greatly. I will have to explain less.
It's a great film.
One of the most bizarre things about California's pistachio industry is that it was born out of America's meddling in the Middle East. Historically, Iran has always been the world's biggest exporter of pistachios. But the embargo allowed California's tiny industry to get a global foothold. And after several decades of continued hostility and sanctions, the U.S. industry grew from being almost non-existent to number one in the world. As I dug into the details, I realized that this was much bigger than just Victoril. It turned out that a small group of powerful families had seized control of California's water supply. Even weirder was that the whole thing was being driven by a pair of high society billionaires from Beverly Hills, Stuart and Linda Resnick. They made their money off pistachios. But what really made them stand out was that they owned more water than anyone else on the planet. More surprisingly, they were on the board of several major think tanks, including the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. They've been on the board for over a decade. It's an organization that badly wants war with Iran.
I frankly think that crisis initiation is really tough. And it's very hard for me to see how the United States president can get us to war with Iran. One can combine other means of pressure with sanctions. We could step up the pressure. I mean, look, people, Iranian submarines periodically go down. Someday one of them might not come up. Who would know why?
Wow. So that is a great, great trailer for a great film, by the way.
It's more like a cut. It's more like a, actually, it's like a bit of a cut down of how the kind of it relates to the geopolitics and to new conservative politics and to Iran. It's like a little, it's actually not like officially a trailer, but yeah. So it gives a little bit more than a trailer would, you know? But yeah, no, I think it's a great little intro to the topic, you know, connecting the things.
Yeah. And you have a great voice.
Thank you.
Great voice for that. So, but tell us more about the relationship between, you know, the Resnicks, the lobby, that lobbying group that they are part of, that organization, because everyone knows about AIPAC, but not everyone knows about the other ones.
The organization that we were featuring there, and the speaker who was talking about, you know, basically doing a false flag attack to start a war with Iran, doing like a kind of a Vietnam War kind of thing, where you basically attack one of their ships and or submarines and then, you know, get them to try to respond to you in some way and then, you know, to go to war, like what's happening now, essentially. That's called WINEP. It stands for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It's like, it's just a...
Yeah, they always try to make it sound like they're smart.
Smart, and it's like some kind of academic think tank. Really, it's an AIPAC spinoff. It was actually specifically spun off of AIPAC because AIPAC, you know, already... this was several decades ago, was already, you know, it doesn't have the best name in the business. It's essentially known as a front for Israel and representing is the interests of Israel. And so they needed something that had more credibility, that had more, you know, that didn't have that baggage. And so they created as a spinoff project and spun it off independently. And WINEP, you know, basically took on all these, it was just like a neoconservative like hangout. You know, I think the Bush administration and Cheney in particular, his team, you know, a lot of the people on his foreign policy team came from there, you know, were these sort of resident fellows, you know, basically it's, you know, how these things are in Washington, D.C. You create these organizations for when you're out of power, you kind of can go cool your heels, make a bunch of money, essentially do lobbying and kind of academic work and put out books and make money while your party is out of power or while your clan is out of power. Whenever you come back in power, you like, that's where the administration draws the talent. You know, it's kind of a normal thing for both parties in Washington, D.C. And it's like one of these things. So it's a lobby group. It's a think tank that is like concentrates, you know, the most hardline pro-war voices and interests. And, you know, it's not just about Iran, but just generally speaking, these are the most like the regime change oriented people. New conservatives, people used to call them, you know, and you know that word isn't used so much, you know, but it's like the labels change, but really the policies remain the same. I was surprised, you know, when I first started reporting on the Resniks back in 2000, and I'm always like, don't want to say it, 2009, you know, that's when I first started reporting on the Resniks, and it through like was first interested in their water politics because I was in California reporting on real estate speculation, and water was like a key aspect to real estate speculation because you need water to build homes and sell it to Wall Street and all this stuff. But then I found them they had like the largest chunk of water in California under their control, private control. And very quickly I realized, you know, made the connection between their wealth, their pistachio business and the foreign policy of the United States of America. And their role in like these pistachio, you know, these farmers like who no one really even knew back then, were on the boards of all these like neoconservative Bush administration, kind of Republican, really Republican oriented think tanks who were very, very hardline on Iran. And it was very strange because I was like, oh, these are like liberal donors. They're like backing, you know, Barack Obama. They're, you know, they're like generally they vote, at least they back Democratic Party candidates. They're like, and you know, have Arianna Huffington when she was still a thing over at their house, you know, and have these liberal parties and have all these liberal kind of historians and all these people who are kind of part of the liberal world. Like yet they're like in bed with the kind of the rankest Republican Party, new conservatives. And it was just like, what was going on there? And it became very clear. It's because their entire business, their pistachio business, which is like the base of their wealth. It's not the only source of their wealth at this point, but it's the base of it. It is tied directly to American regime change in the Middle East and specifically in Iran, going back to the first elected government in a democratically elected government in Iran, which was toppled by the CIA, and with the Shah being kind of reinstalled as an American puppet, and then that led to a revolution in Iran, which resulted in the current government coming to power, right? And so. And then, you know, which then triggered all these sanctions against Iran, starting with the Carter administration. And it's the imposition of these sanctions in response to what was at the time a broad-based popular movement to overthrow a hated leader, right? These sanctions that are imposed by Carter were the genesis of the pistachio industry in America.
You think he had a conflict of interest because of the whole peanut farmer thing?
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think he could foresee it at that moment because pistachios weren't like, you know, it wasn't like a global commodity that was really sought that people were fighting to get or to buy. I mean, it was a pretty fringe thing. I mean, it was actually very organically embedded in a lot of cultures, particularly, you know, in the Middle East. But it wasn't like something that people were clamoring to grow or to buy in America or around the world. Actually, the Resniks single-handedly helped create the pistachio market through marketing, through this very, very aggressive, very well-funded marketing campaigns. I mean, no one ate pistachios in America. If you remember, you grew up in America, no one ate pistachios when you were younger, I'm sure. They were like in probably specialty stores, right? If you go to like a Persian store in Westwood in Los Angeles, there'll be pistachios there, you know? And then those pistachios would have come from Iran, or they would have come from quote unquote Turkey, which are frequently essentially like Iranian pistachios that are kind of just, you know, sanctions washed, you know, and they're sort of, you know, but that it would be these specialty stores from cultures that actually eat pistachios. There weren't like a mass snack food, which they've become today. You know, you go to any grocery store, any gas station actually, and there'll be these like wonderful pistachios just like in your face. And so, Carter, it'd be pretty funny if there was like a secret, nut monopoly, you know, controlling world affairs. They're like, okay, you know, the peanut farmers can the peanut farmers can get Latin America, you know, the pistachio farmers get the Middle East, you know, this kind of stuff. They divvy up the world. But it wasn't. It was just like when the sanctions kicked in, suddenly there are these farmers who were beginning to experiment with pistachios. I think it was already kind of like there were these experimental programs no one was really doing because the climate is very similar in the Central Valley in California. And then it was like, oh, wait, so suddenly the market is cut off. Oh, well, there's a reason to actually invest in this right now. And then as time went on, of course, you know, then there is an interest. Then there's a conflict of interest. Then you have these farmers who actually then depend on sanctions to in order to protect their business. And especially when it was still developing, the sanctions were important, you know. And so from then on, pistachio farmers, the Resniks, you know, being kind of the first ones that really understood like the gold mine that they were potentially sitting on and really invested in it heavily and expanded it, they've gone fully into the sanctions regime and, you know, basically funding organizations and think tanks and institutions that have a maximalist position with respect to Iran.
Wow. We don't know if they've said anything about this war, do we? The Resniks? They're probably not going to do that openly, right?
No, I haven't. You know, look, no, they have not said anything about it. And just generally speaking, they're extremely PR savvy. They know that the best, you know, thing to do is just never to comment. And to be honest, they're, you know, a lot of what they're, you know, they'd like to keep their hand in this hidden. You know, it doesn't look good, you know, for their business. They don't like, you know, the negative attention that they're getting. And so they haven't commented, you know, and so they actually generally don't comment on politics or geopolitics only when they're forced to, you know, when they can't not say something. But at this point, no one's asking him even the question, you know, and I want to say, you know, I don't think that they're like the primary drivers of the war. You know, it's not because of the pistachio industry, because the pistachio industry for, you know, the billions of dollars it generates, it's not like a huge industry. But for me, what's interesting about the role the pistachio plays is that how embedded some of like the more innocuous like products and businesses that you think are kind of innocuous and aren't connected to foreign policy or you know, this really, really hawkish interventionist foreign policy that America pursues, that you don't think they're really connected. And yet, like, you scratch the surface and you find them in an unexpected way. So basically, business interests, big and small, have an interest or have a stake, you know, in these conflicts, right? Whether it's Iran or Ukraine or other things. So there's money to be made and there's interest. So there's almost like a consensus in the consensus in the business community, right? So it's not just like the oil companies and the weapons makers or whatever. There are other small businesses who also have a role to play. And so it is important, you know, like for a kind of a ruling class consensus or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I want to ask you something about that I keep asking my guests, which is, what is driving this? You know, there's this big debate and it's not one thing or another, but, you know, a lot of people say Israel is doing, what is it like? Israel is making the U.S. do this for Israel's sake. Then that's a big narrative that you have, especially now that you have a lot of America firsters who are critical of Israel. And then other people say, no, it's the United States that uses Israel. And then other people say it's a cycle or it's neither one of those things.
Yeah. No, that's a big debate. I know. I mean, I don't know. I do think that, you know, I mean, on some level, you know, you were just in Cuba. I know I've never been to Cuba, but my sense of it is, you know, on some level, what America is doing to Iran is very similar to what it's doing to Cuba, right? And in that sense, in the Cuba instance, there's no Israeli lobby there. I mean, you could maybe make an argument, you know, some maybe would, that there's, oh, the casinos are owned by the Jewish mafia.
And they lobby, want to bring... but it's like a...
Yeah, but I think lobby. The Cuba lobby is more Torah. Yeah, it's not Jewish. I mean, I'd say some people would probably be able to dig up Jewish ties because there were. I mean, actually, it's in like... you know, it's the Jewish mafia had control in the casinos in Havana, you know, but again, that's not what's driving, you know, the foreign policy. I think the foreign policy is that in essence, you know, America tries to wipe out any resistance to its rule. It's a fucking empire, you know? And so it's not, it doesn't like it when societies or cultures or countries or whatever you want to call them, push back effectively. And the longer that they resist, you know, and the longer that they kind of stand on their own 2 feet, the more, you know, insane this country gets. I mean, to the point where they're starving Cuba completely, you know, I mean, it's just insane, you know, for what? There is no real benefit. Maybe some, you know, a couple of plantation owners will make some money again, but it's not like it's, you know, for an empire the size of America, you know, that island is really not like a central part of, you know, the economy, you know, to the point. So, or those people cannot be driving it, but it is, I think there are some interests, obviously, but then I think there's a larger, so I don't think that, again, Israel it plays a part in it because Israel is so intertwined with America, you know, I mean, the ruling class is very intertwined. I mean, there's like a shared cultural identity, religious, affinity of like Christian Zionism and that strain of Christianity. And, you know, Israel has been a great wrecker in the region. I mean, essentially, Israel has helped America wipe out every resistance to American power in the region, you know, if you just look at the wreck, you know, that surrounds Israel. And a lot of those countries had, you know, opposition or had at least independent foreign policies or, you know, when the Soviet Union still existed, they were sort of, you know, they were used, you know, we're kind of between the Soviet Union and America and, you know, try to chart some kind of independent course. And so, I mean, so I think it's a combination of factors. With Iran, I think it's just, I don't know, it's like, you know, and also just fucking stupidity. I don't know. Trump is Trump and his people are just, I don't know, they're just, they just have like, have never, it's just, it's to go into this war like this. And, you know, at least in the short term, kind of lose so badly for such a powerful empire to, you know, to basically get stopped like that, you know, to completely get stopped. And then, you know, now you got to like work to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. And it's like, well, it was open before, you know, so like, you know, the shifting goalposts of the, so I think there's overlapping interests, but I think just America hates anything it's kind of normal for an empire that's not used to sharing power with anybody, you know? Yeah. So it's kind of, you know, not the first time in history. Yeah.
Right. The thing that drives me crazy when I hear it, like when America firsters talk about what's happening now in the Middle East and they say about America, like, this isn't who we are. It's like, yes, of course it's who we are. Like we may be, yes, there may be certain things that Israel is having us do, but this weird, it's good that more and more people are becoming aware of Israel's demonic nature, but you know, yes, we don't want them to then say like, oh, before Israel, the United States was such a beacon of democracy.
I know. It's nice. I agree with you. It's nice for people to think that, I mean, I don't know. It's complicated. You know, if you're an American, you know, or if you're a European person and, and you see your country supporting, you know, this kind of horrific stuff. And it's easier to like, you know, to like look in the mirror and say, hey, you know, I'm from a society that has, you know, has a pretty dark history that has done things like this in the past to all sorts of cultures, than to just say, actually, no, there's this entity that's an external force that if we remove this force, then we will, you know, become normal countries again and we won't be these like, you know, child murdering monsters. You know, like I understand the psychological kind of cope that people have, and it's easier to think that way. But it's like, it's just, yeah, I know. I mean, I've gotten a lot of shit on it. You know, it's like, it's like a contentious topic. And even to qualify the power of the Jewish lobby as a Jewish person, you know, I'm like, you know, you're immediately accused of being, you know, a crypto Zionist, you know, oh, you Jews all are all the same. You all stick together, you know, all this stuff. It's like, you know, I get it. I've gotten it, quite a bit of it. I think it's whatever, you know, it's how it is, but it's just, the history is complicated. You know, things are something that was very simple, but to just present, you know, a bloody empire like America as like, you know, complete lamb, you know, that is just being led to do all these horrible things by this evil society that's sort of, you know, attached itself like some kind of squid to its head and is forcing it to do things. It's kind of ridiculous. I mean, America is a very powerful country. You know, if money was the end of all things in America, then China would be, you know, America would be pro-China. China has a lot more money than Israel, like a lot more money, you know, and a lot more economic power. So if it was just about money and throwing money around and buying, you know, it's like, there's a reason why Israel is allowed to do these things, is because it overlaps with a kind of, I don't know, it's like a consensus. It's like this elite consensus. It's not always 100%. Not everybody's on board, but there's a consensus that thinks that what is good for Israel is good for America and vice versa, you know?
Right. Yeah. And then you do have AIPAC, and then you have like Kufi, right? So you have the Christians United for Israel. Then you have AIPAC.
Exactly. And no one talks about those. Those are like kind of not even broad. And you could, because a lot of the Zionist stuff is, I mean, look, you know, Jews are, as a Jewish person, we're like, you know, it's a funny thing. Like Zionists are think that they're kind of using the Christian Zionists to get their way. And then the Christian Zionists are thinking that they're using the stupid Jews who are going to be all wiped out in Armageddon.
Exactly. Right. Right.
To get their way. So it's like there's this kind of like weird, almost like a poker game or something being played between these two entities, thinking that they're, each of them is smarter than the other one, is like not actually truly getting what they want. In the end, like America as an empire destroys all of its opposition in the Middle East completely. I mean, and now Lebanon is like the last little bastion of a, you know, I mean, it's being completely destroyed. It's really fucked up, you know? I mean, Syria was just completely annihilated and taken out. I mean, I think it's more complicated than just, Jews, you know, controlling, you know, society and forcing America to go against its interests,
which is funny because, I mean, you and I are both we used to only get shit from Zionists, right? Like we were bad Jews because we were self-loathing Jews, you know, as a Jew, Jews.
Yes.
And we always do. I mean, I still do obviously like call out when people say something's anti-Semitic, but it's actually anti-Zionist. But what's weird is that, yes, like, thanks to, I think, like, X becoming the way it is, and thanks to, yes, Israel doing what it's doing while claiming to represent all Jews, like, there is something coming up. But we're sensitive to the fact that it's, like, that doesn't mean that when Sheryl Sandberg says, like, will you hide me? Like has anything to be worried about, you know? We're talking about something that's not, like, you know, it was not a Jewish kid who was stabbed multiple times to death after October 7th, right? It was a Palestinian kid. It wasn't like Jewish people who were like going to be thrown into a pool by a woman in Texas. You know, those were Palestinian kids.
Yes,
but there's something there. And then if you
and there was like an attack. Remember, there was a guy went and shot up a couple of people outside of a Jewish event in Washington D.C. Right? They happened, but I mean, but look, it's,
although those were, that was an Israeli thing actually.
Exactly.
But there was
exactly. It was an Israeli embassy thing. Yeah.
There was the Bondi Beach massacre, obviously, and then the thing in Michigan more recently. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, they exist, but look, the fact of the matter is, you know, you're an American, you know, more than I am because you grew up here. I came when I was nine, you know, to America. But America is a very safe place for Jews. It always has been. You know, in fact, you know, America, I would say, is the safest place for Jews in the history of Judaism. Probably. I don't know. You know, it's a good question. Actually, we do wonder because I think even New York City was the first city in the world where Jews could run in municipal elections and could fully participate. There were restrictions on Jews.
Yeah, but now Zoran's taking that back. Zoran's taking it away.
Exactly. There were six. So, and this is like, you know, this is even going back to Anyway, so there's never been like, you know, America is this extremely safe place for Jews. And yeah, this constant crying about, you know, every criticism of Israel as is an anti-Semitic act by the American sort of Zionist Jewish lobby in, here is like really muddied the waters. And but the fact is, the matter is that whatever is like going to be happening to Jews in America, to whatever backlash there is going to be, it's it will be directly related to the actions of Israel, and to like to frankly the, you know, the pretty hardcore, which are like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that Israel is begging people to develop and it's like, so it's like, you know, in this case, like there is an actual embodied real reason for what, if there is an anti, if there is anti-Semitism coming, and it does seem like at least, you know, online, you know, in on certain sites when like the filters have been lifted, it's a lot more, you know, hardcore than anything I've ever seen, in online discourse outside of like 4chan or something, you know. I mean, it's just like normalized, you know, and so but again, it should be, you know, it's like, but again, I guarantee you, if, you know, Israel stops killing people, stops the genocide, it'll be better, you know. Jews will be a lot safer, you know. So, you know, if there's a direct connection between Israel's actions and the rising climate of this. So yeah, it's, but you know, I don't know. I've like stopped really arguing with people online about this stuff, because it's just people have their positions, and it's hard to move them, you know.
So I know I should ignore the chats, but it is funny. Someone was like, many Zionists here. I think they must mean the chat. Okay, not us, obviously, because we're both anti-Zionist. But
yeah, I don't know. Who knows? Yeah,
who knows? Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty anti-Zionist, but you know, I don't know what, I don't know how you can prove it, you know.
Katie, I could be wrong, but someone else earlier on commented asking if anyone had done any reporting on the Zionist, quote, the Zionist enclaves in Florida. And so perhaps that person was commenting saying there's a lot of Zionists in Florida.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, got it. Well, in Florida, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You got four, like you got the Zionist and the Cuban. You got the, you know, the pro-Israel, quote-unquote pro-Israel, and the pro whatever you want,
exactly.
The Castro people, yeah.
The lobby stuff is, Israel has been, let's be honest, you know, Israel, it's because of, there's a kind of an interesting, you know, it's a very Jewish kind of way of interacting with the world in a way. It's very dark, because even if you take it at face value, you know, it's like, oh, we are, you know, like, Europe is anti-Semitic, you know, they hate the Jews. So, and they say that, you know, all these European nationalists say that, oh, you know, and a real nation, you know, real people, they need their own land. They need their own nation to grow. It's like, well, we're going to take the hint, and we're going to try to create our own nation. It's going to be a Jewish nation. We're going to thrive there. We're going to be safe there. We're never going to, there are not going to be any pogroms anymore. And look, you know, there's a Holocaust. And if only we had the Jewish state, yeah, we'd be have no Holocaust. And then like, you create this Jewish state, you terrorize the people who used to live there, kick them out, do ethnic cleansing, do genocide. And in so doing, you know, for this, like in pursuit of Jewish safety, you create the most dangerous situation for Jews worldwide. I don't even know how, you know, for how long since Hitler, you know, and so I don't know. It's like, there's like a total insanity. Even if you take it at face value that all you're trying to do is like provide safety to Jews, you know, with the Zionist kind of message,
right.
It's like 100% counterproductive. And so you have to wonder, you know, maybe that's not what the point of that whole movement is. You know?
Right. Yeah. I don't think it was.
You know, I know, I'm just being, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you're being sorry. I'm being so dumb. I'm like so sarcastic.
No, I'm being a bit sarcastic.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but yeah. Sometimes my sarcasm door is like really off, which is so
hypocritical. It's hard sometimes.
It's so hypocritical because I'm so sarcastic. But tell us about, actually, I didn't plan to ask you about this, but about the relationship between Israel and the Soviet Union, and how all these Russians went to Israel afterwards, and they pretended to be Jewish. Some of them aren't even. Well, that was a great show. And if you are watching this now, you are in luck because we just did this great stream and you got to see it. If you're watching this later and you want to see the full stream with Yasha, where we get into lots of really fascinating topics ranging from Russia and Ukraine, why the Palantir manifesto is just, they're trolling us. What else is a great thing that we get into? Some secret organization that's more secret than Mossad or KGB, yeah, AI. Well, again, guys, if you haven't already, please do like the stream. Please do subscribe. Please become Patreon supporters. Thank you, Phantom with Fanta. Hope you're feeling better. Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Nate. And see everyone on Thursday at 12 p.m. for an interview with Omar Suleiman. Also, you're going to find out there's a Chuck Schumer clip going around. I played that clip. You know what? Can we just show this clip? I just got to show it. So guys, I don't mean to brag. A lot of people are sharing this clip of Chuck Schumer saying some really ridiculous things, rightly so. It's a ridiculous thing that he says. It's really offensive. And people are like, this must be condemned, or why won't people ask Chuck Schumer about it? And I'm glad you guys are offended by this video, but this is a reminder of why you should be liking and subscribing to and Patreon supporting the Katie Halper Show. Because who talked about this years ago? This video is actually from 2018. People think it's like coming out recently. Well, it's from 2018. And by 2019, Katie Halper was talking about it. So let's take a look at me on Laura Ingraham. I went on to defend Ilhan Omar. This is a great like triple threat because I defend Ilhan Omar, go after AIPAC and Chuck Schumer. And then the other thing I do is I get to fight with Matt Schlapp, who, as people remember, is that weird CPAC guy who says that it's hypocritical to talk about women and girls being killed in Iran because they would otherwise have to wear burqas and have limited career choices. He also a Christian man who cares about women's rights. He probably, if he cares about women's rights, he should probably divorce his wife because he has been accused of sexually harassing and assaulting a couple of young men. So all of which is to say, let's take a look at this clip.
That Omar's comments are both not anti-Semitic, and you didn't have a problem, I imagine, with the first comments.
No, I mean, I have a problem with hearing her as an anti-Semite. She said something, this is how anti-Semitic it was, apparently. She said something that Thomas Friedman, major supporter of Israel, has said. Thomas Friedman said an applause that Bibi Netanyahu received was paid for by the Israel lobby. There's nothing anti-Semitic in there. What is anti-Semitic, though, if you want to talk about anti-Semitic tropes and playing into those, is what Kevin McCarthy, who along with Donald Trump is going after Omar, what he said in a tweet that he deleted, Soros and Bloomberg and Steyer were buying the election. Now, that is an anti-Semitic trope that he definitely played into. He deleted the tweet, but he never apologized. Schumer has said things that are very Islamophobic, for instance, and no one asked him to apologize. There's this double standard.
But no pattern. You see no pattern among some of these newer congresswomen who seem to equate money with Jews.
You're equated with anti-Semitism. Chuck Schumer, for instance, said that there's no peace in the Middle East because Palestinians don't follow the Torah.
Okay, so Katie. Of course, we say it's our land. The Torah says it. But they don't believe in the Torah. So that's the reason there is not peace.
Which is theocracy.
The reason why there is a state of Israel is because the Jewish people were almost exterminated from the face of the globe, and they did not have a sanctuary place they could go to have their own state. There wasn't a state for Jews to be able to call their own.
And by the way, it's there. It's there.
And by the way, it's there. And it's their lands. We don't have to agree with absolutely every decision their government makes, but it is wrong to attack them as a people.
Well, no one attacked them as a people, luckily.
I just saw that tweet.
AIPAC. I'm a Jew. I'm a person. No one attacked me because I don't support AIPAC. Millions of Jews don't support AIPAC, and that's why there are all these alternatives.
But this is the problem.
Because Jews like me are really tired of having AIPAC, which is a very small but very powerful elite minority representation of Jews. It's very tiresome to have them claim to speak for all Jews and conflate Jewish identity with unquestioning support of Israel, which is an anti-Semitic trope in itself.
Let me just say this, Lord. This is the big dynamic.
It would be nice if Donald Trump had actually condemned the people in Charlottesville. And
this is
Matt,
the dynamic.
You work in his communications,
if I could please just answer,
why didn't we're making it.
This is the dynamic. Let's stay.
Okay,
on
okay, guys, I got to tell you,
guys, stop. Statement. So, guys, if you just saw that Chuck Schumer clip, welcome to the club of observant people.
Yeah, it seems a characteristic of a leftist generally is that you are correct too early. And that's just kind of the row you hoe, you know?
Yeah. What did you call me? I'm just kidding. That is just the row you hoe. So anyway, well, that is why you got to stick with the Katie Helper show, because then you're in the know and you don't post clips of Chuck Schumer from like 8 years ago and think that they're new. Because again, I'm just telling you, we're at the forefront here. We follow these people. We talk about it. There's another clip of him saying that Gaza had to be strangled economically. Lovely people. And that is why Norman Finkelstein calls Chuck Schumer, his former classmate, because they both went to the same high school. He calls him a moral monster.
Wow. You think they went at the same time?
I can't remember. I think let's see, how old is Schumer and how old is Norman? Schumer's 75. Norman is obviously younger than that. Norm is actually not as young. Norman looks way younger than he is, actually. And then 72, according to Nate. And then, God, can you believe there's only a 3-year difference? We got to mock up a thing. It's like, this is what Zionism does to your soul and your face. Well, thank you guys so much. And we will see you. Yes, not all Zionists are Semitic. Therefore, anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Exactly. And saying that it is actually anti-Semitic. All right. I will see you guys on Thursday. Bye, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.